Good morning. Well, I know a lot of you have been praying for me this week, and I want you to know that I have felt your prayers, and I actually feel great today. And I'm looking forward to sharing how God has worked in my life and hopefully inspire you that he can do the same for you. I want to welcome my ERC family, who I love dearly. And some of my own family is here. My oldest brother, Glenn, is here, and my daughter, Melanie, is here. And some friends from Morristown, Steve and Lisa, came to support me. And my new friend, my beautiful new friend, Latoya, who I just met today for the first time. We've become friends through a meaningful dialogue we've been having on Facebook. And she lives in Burlington, and she came here today to support me. So I really appreciate it. She's here with her daughter and her son. Today, October 4th, is my mother and father's anniversary. If they were still living, it would have been 73 years today. So I want to start by sharing a little bit about my mom and dad. My dad grew up in rural Georgia on a farm in 1922. They were very poor. They raised all their own food. They had livestock. My dad grew up plowing fields, butchering hogs, doing all kinds of things. They had pecan trees. They had fruit trees. They did everything like that. And his sisters, my aunts, actually picked cotton on neighboring farms. As teenagers, they all did this. Now, my dad left Georgia in 1939 to join the Army. He was only 17, I believe. And then when World War II broke out, he was sent to Australia. Now, the Americans were in Australia to prevent the Japanese from invading them and taking over their country. And my mother used to tell us it was very exciting times in Australia during the war. She was 21 at the time my dad was there. And they had soldiers there from everywhere, you know, France and England and Holland, all the Allied countries. And my mother was from Melbourne. Now, if you're not too familiar with the geography of Australia, Melbourne's in the state of Victoria, which is the southeast end of the continent. Where my dad was up in the tropics, which it's the opposite because they're in the southern hemisphere, the opposite of us. Up north is where it's hot. So my dad was up in a place called Townsville, and that's where the soldiers were. Now, I don't really know how it happened that he was in Melbourne, because that's where he met my mother. Maybe they were on leave or something. I'm not sure. But he met my mother, and they fell in love, and they wanted to get married. So my father's back up north. My mother had to travel by ship up the side of Australia to meet him for marriage, and it was dangerous. This was wartime, and the northern waters of Australia at that time were being mined by the Japanese. So they got married, and my sister Judy and my oldest brother Glenn, who's here today, were both born in Australia. Now, they become automatic citizens because of my father. And my mother became what was known as a war bride. And there were war brides all over the world. The soldiers married women, you know, in Japan and Germany, everywhere. So my mother was a war bride. After the war was over, or maybe even before, my father came back to the United States. And my mother and the kids were still there. It took some time, some paperwork, for my mother to come over. Now, 1946, the war's over, and my mother's traveling to the United States with two babies on a troop ship that's bringing soldiers back. There were other war brides and other kids on the ship, I'm sure. There were. I know that. I'm sorry. But anyway, she had a two-week journey on this ship back to San Francisco. Now, remember, there were no disposable diapers at that time. There were no little jars of Gerber's baby food. So I can't imagine how challenging that must have been. But she told us everybody helped them. The men helped the women. You know, it was amazing. Then when she got to San Francisco, she had a train trip to make all the way to the East Coast, to Georgia, where my father's home is, again with two babies. Now, when she gets to Georgia, my father's family were farm people, simple people, Southern Baptist people, and here's my mother, an Aussie, two kids, and they loved her, of course, took her in, loved the kids, all that. But my mother and father didn't want to make their home there. My father didn't have a lot of opportunity there, and they didn't want that life for them and for their kids, and mostly probably because there wasn't a lot of opportunity. So my dad reenlisted and stayed in the Army, and he served in the Army for 20 years. We moved around many places. We lived in Texas. We lived in Arizona. We lived in Michigan, Maryland. We had a year in Japan. You know, the typical Army life. So my point here is that my father was really the only one that left Georgia permanently out of his clan. My mother gave up her culture and her country and family to come here. They were very adventurous people, and I inherited that from them. In the mid-60s, my father retired from the Army, and then he took a civil service position at McGuire Air Force Base, where he served another 20 years. They owned a home in Mount Holly, and that's where I went to high school. Now, growing up, most of my female role models were housewives. For your frame of reference, I'll tell you, I'm 66 years old. I graduated high school in 1967, and I didn't attend college. So at this time, there weren't a lot of women in the workforce like we have today. It was a different era. So most of my role models were housewives. But I didn't want that for myself. I didn't envision that life for myself. I had grand ideas of travel and, you know, adventure. However, after graduating from high school, I did marry about a year later, I did marry my first real boyfriend, and I became pregnant with my oldest daughter, Robin. This is 1968. I had a job at a bank full time. My husband's aunt was babysitting for us. One day I came home from work. We'd been married about 15 months, something like that. I came home from work and he was gone. He deserted us. And it was 10 years before I really knew what happened. He had taken off to California with one of his friends. And my daughter, Robin, never even met him until she was 15. So this was kind of a rough start. I had been raised very protected by my father. I was pretty naive. And so now here I was. So after being left alone with the baby, I went to live with my sister and her family up in Massachusetts. And that's where I met my second husband, Butch. He had recently returned from the war in Vietnam. This is the early 70s. He accepted Robin as his own child, and together we had my daughter, Melanie. Now, you have to remember, this was the time of the hippies and all that, and we were very much a part of the scene, although we were responsible parents. We loved our kids, and they were taken care of. But we were in the scene. My husband did develop somewhat of a drug and alcohol problem, which, thankfully for me, I never had those weaknesses. I have other weaknesses, but drugs and alcohol were not them, thank goodness. So we did end up being divorced. And that is a divorce that should not have happened, and I take a lot of responsibility for that divorce, because if I'd been a Christian at the time, I would have helped him, and we would have overcome those difficulties. But we did divorce. And then I had a short third marriage. This time I married a man from Egypt who was a Muslim. But that's another story, and I really don't want to get into that one today. If you want to ever hear about that, I'll talk to you one-on-one. I was only with him for 2 years, and we were divorced. So after that, I was single for 13 years. The summer of 1990, Melanie and I went on vacation in Jamaica. And I became fast friends with a woman there named Tamara. We hung out together the whole week and had a lot of fun. She lived in San Francisco. I was 40. Diane, you would love San Francisco. You got to come. Please come and see me. This is your kind of town. And well, she picked up on my worldly life at the time, and sure. After two visits, I decided I got to live here. This is what I want. I'd always wanted an urban experience, and I saw San Francisco as a livable city, you know, as opposed to many others. So I relocated to San Francisco in 1991, and Melanie joined me there in April. I went in January. I had $6,000 and a whole lot of ambition. I was 41 at the time and pretty much at the top of my game. I was very professional, polished kind of person at that time. I was in shape. You know, the whole bit. I was good. So as soon as I get to the city, I go to a temp agency. I'm living in an apartment hotel with a little two-burner hot plate and a little fridge. And I get a call from the agency, like, on the third day, and they said they had a temp job for me with a local celebrity. So I'm like, a local celebrity? I forgot to bring my water up. John, it's right there. It's right there on the thing. Yeah, thank you. So, of course, they kept me hanging for 3 or 4 days. And, turns out the assignment was with the famous author Daniel Steele. I worked in her Pacific Heights mansion for 3 weeks while her office manager was in Mexico. That was a real experience, I'll tell you. And I knew her. I mean, I went to her bedroom to pick up papers, and she's in her bathroom and everything. It was pretty cool. And so here's this little Jersey girl fresh in the city, and I'm in this mansion in Pacific Heights. Her neighbor was Linda Ronstadt. She doesn't live in that house anymore, and her husband, who was John Trina, is since deceased, and I don't know what she's doing nowadays, but anyway, it was pretty heady for the time. Then I had a second temp job, and then the third one was with American Star Insurance Company. And I made close friends with Jan, who was the corporate secretary in the executive department of this company. And she really wanted to hire me permanently, so they hired me permanently, and I was assistant to the CEO, the CFO, and her. And we were on the 22nd floor of this beautiful skyscraper in San Fran. And, of course, my office is in the interior, but they're out there, you know, the executives had all the glass windows. And the views out their windows were like the Coit Tower, you know, the marina, you could see it all. And, again, it was just incredible. So this was pretty much the most enjoyable time of my life, I have to say. I was a tourist. I didn't own a car, which, like, that was the greatest freedom in the world, not owning a car. Not having to put your butt in a car to go somewhere. You know, I rode the cable cars, I walked, we rode the Muni, the BART system, subway we rode. And I was dating, I was going to the nightclubs. I mean, I was really living it up. I thought, you know, this is it. This is the good life. So what did I consider the good life at that time? First and most important was looking good. Pursuing pleasure and having the goods, material possessions, good food, going to restaurants, going to Napa Valley, whatever, that was what was important to me. American Star went under. They actually were failing. They were laying people off, and they were going to go out of business. So before that happened, I started looking for another job. I got another job working for two attorneys in the city. And again, it was fabulous. We were on, it was 601 Montgomery Street. We were right across the street from that big Transamerica building that you see in the skyline. It looks like a pyramid and everything. We were right across the street from that. They were great to me. Had lots of fun times and lunches. And Kevin Fink was the main attorney that I worked for. He took us on an outing up to Napa. And we went on the wine train and all this other stuff. So that was great. But I knew this was not a position that I wanted to stay with for the long term. So I started looking. So an opportunity came up at the Mark Hopkins Hotel, which is part of the Intercontinental Hotel chain, on the top of Nob Hill, which was like a less than 10-minute walk from where I lived in the Union Square District. I had two interviews there. The position was to be assistant to the general manager of this fabulous hotel at the top of Nob Hill. This place was like the ultimate. They had high tea at 4 in the afternoon. The woman who interviewed me showed me the cafeteria where all the help ate for free, gourmet foods and everything. This was like the dream job that I had been preparing for all my life, okay, being assistant to this general manager guy who also oversaw the big hotel in Hawaii. Oh, okay, I'm going to Hawaii next. And then I found out I could have went anywhere in the world and stayed at these intercontinental hotels if I secured this position. Well, I had two interviews, hadn't met the general manager yet. That was going to come on the third. And I felt very confident that I was going to get this position. But then life kind of gave me a big curve. My father developed lung cancer. So my mother called me. Dad's got a big tumor in his lung. The doctor surmises it's probably been there about 8 years. It's already spread to his bone, and the prognosis was not good. So what do I do now? I love my father. I was a daddy's girl. My mom and dad had been there for me through everything, and believe me, I put them through a lot. And I believe in honoring my parents. So I knew right then, I'm going home. I'm going to have to go home. I have to give up this good life, you know. So this was May. I actually went home in September. Do I have any regrets about coming back to New Jersey? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But it was a culture shock. Here I am now back on Route 130 in Burlington on 295. You know, it's like, oh. And, of course, the worst part was that my father was sick and dying and suffering. Now, up to this point in my life, I certainly believed in God. We had not been raised in the church, but we always had Bibles. We were taught to pray. My father had been raised a Baptist, after all. So he recited scripture even every now and then. And I always felt blessed. Somehow, always in my life, I did feel blessed and protected by the Lord. And believe me, I was in a lot of dangerous situations in my life because I was a little adventurous, like I said. I mean, when I went to Jamaica 3 times. I made friends with Jamaicans in the hotel and went to where they lived. And anything could have happened to me. I mean, God always protected me, and I really feel that. So anyway, now I'm back home. My sister is living up in Bethlehem, PA, and her husband are attending a Nazarene church. Well, there's a Nazarene church in Burlington where I was living right then, in an apartment that my parents had secured for me before I came home. They gave me Dad's car. Diane, you want to go to that Nazarene church? I'll come down one Sunday and I'll go with you, because she knew I was shy about going to church. I said, okay. So, it put it off a little bit, but then she came down and we went to this Nazarene church. And I knew the Nazarene church was one of those loving kind of churches where you walk in and everybody welcomes you and loves you. And, you know, and I needed that. I was really suffering. So that's exactly what happened when I went in this Nazarene church. The people were wonderful. We got greeted. Then Melanie was coming with me, and it was great. When my father passed away, not long after that, people from that church actually came to my apartment to see me and pray with me, and they hardly knew me. I'd only been going there maybe 3 or 4 weeks. But then after Dad died, I stopped going. And I was just in a bad way. It was a dark period. Then I moved to Cherry Hill, and there was a Nazarene church in Mount Laurel. One Sunday, kind of on an impulse, one weekend, I should say, because I probably decided on Saturday, I got up and went to that Nazarene church. And I took my little granddaughter, Jasmine, with me that day. She was only 4. For comfort, you know. That very first day I walked in there, I got greeted the same way as the Burlington church. And after the service was over, several people came over to speak to me and welcome me and talk to me. And one of them was Ed. I met him the very first day I was there. And everybody's like, oh, is that your daughter? Is that your daughter? No, that's my granddaughter. She's 4 years old. Oh, you look too young to be a grandma. I was 47 by this time. You look too young to have a granddaughter and all this. And I remember saying right then, no, I'm old enough to be a grandmother. I'm 47 years old. So Ed knew from day one how old I was. Okay. Because there was 11 and a half year difference in our ages. Ed's only 54 right now. So, but believe me, meeting a man in church was the very last thing on my mind. I didn't even want anybody that was a church guy, believe me. If you're not driving a Porsche or a Corvette or something and taking me to Napa, you know, that was my lifestyle. So, you know, I wasn't there looking to make time with anybody. But I started going to church, and, you know, the Lord started working on me. I gave my life to the Lord at that church. And again, it was a lot of therapy. It really was. But in the meantime, I'm still living my life, because one block from where I lived was the Coastline, which is a nightclub in Cherry Hill. And I could literally walk to it, and I did walk to it. You could walk there, you could walk home. It was great. And I went there probably once a week, maybe twice. And I was still doing my thing, you know, dancing. I wasn't a drinker, but I danced, I'd meet people, get dates, you know, still living that style. But in the meantime, I'm still going to church, and I'm being very much affected by my time in church and being changed, because it's a process. And I start noticing the couples in church, and they're different. They're different than what I've seen before, okay? The men honor the women in a way I wasn't really used to. Some of the people were married the second time. There were widows. There were people that had been married 40 years. There were people that were had been divorced and remarried. You know, everybody was accepted, and there was no legalism there in that regard. So I started noticing these people. I mean, the women weren't all that good-looking, I thought, and the men weren't all that impressive either, but they adored each other. And I'm like, this is nice. And I started wanting that, you know. I wanted a Christian man. That came to me, you know. Now, Ed had been going to that church on and on since he was a teenager. And everybody there loved him. They tried to fix him up with their daughters and everything else. And he'll tell you his story. He had been praying to the Lord that someone would come in the church for him because he wasn't looking anymore. He'd been divorced for 6 years. And he said, I'm not looking anymore. I'm not going outside the church. If you want me to get married again, you're going to bring somebody in the church. And so that was me, okay? This was God's plan all along. He didn't want me going to Hawaii with this hotel and staying single and living that life. That's not what he had in mind for me. I had been through a lot in my life, and he was trying to change it for me, and he did. And, you know, it's hard how God works, you know, because I certainly wouldn't have wanted my father to have had cancer. And my mother was sick with emphysema. She died 4 years after my father did. But this kind of, you know, brought me to my knees, which is how God works, isn't it? He'll do whatever it takes to bring us to him, and that's what he did. And God knew the kind of man that I needed, and that was Ed. And he's a gift. Believe me, he's a gift. We've been married almost 18 years now. They said it wouldn't last. It did. It will. Okay. We have stability. I have stability. I'm settled down for the first time in my life. My parents used to, that's all they'd say to me. When are you going to settle down? When are you going to settle down? Well, you have to realize, because I'd been deserted as a young woman with a baby, I had baggage, trust issues, commitment issues, and that's a lot of why I had problems and why I looked to men just for fun, you know, because I wasn't finding what it was I really needed until I met Ed. So in summary, what most sums up my life is that it's been a great balancing act. The reconciliation of two fundamental needs that I have always had. On the one hand, like most women, I have the need for security, for safety, for dependability, for reliability, for permanence. All the things, all those grounding experiences that we call home. I had that need. These are the anchoring things, right? But I also have an equally strong need for adventure, for novelty, for surprise, for risk, even for danger. That was all part of me, too. For the unexpected. You get the gist. For journey, for travel. You know, I had all of that. And now I'm 66 years old, and, you know, nobody likes to be old. Not that I consider 66 that old yet, but nobody likes to be old, but we don't want to die young, do we? And we have to follow our path. And Pastor Doug has taught us about a worldview. Everyone has a worldview. Whether you know it or not, you have a worldview. And I have a worldview. And what is a worldview? It's what we believe and why we believe it. So, at this age, I've learned that the good life isn't about looking good, feeling good, or having the goods. It's about being good and doing good. Our value doesn't come from the valuables that we have, how pretty we are. There's always going to be somebody prettier. How much money we have. There's always somebody with more money. It comes from serving. It comes from giving ourselves away. It's in the giving our lives away that we find meaning and truth. And that is why I'm studying Spanish right now at Mercer County Community College. Because this is one thing I came up with that I could do. I care about the immigrants and that they want to speak our language. They do want to. It is not easy to learn a foreign language. There are places you can go and get free English lessons if you're a Spanish-speaking person, at the libraries, at the school, maybe even through our Free Indeed ministry, we might do something like that someday. So this is something I thought I could do. I've always wanted to learn Spanish anyway for years, but was too lazy to do it. I want to learn to speak Spanish, and if I help one person learn the language enough that they can get a good job and they can fill out paperwork and they can do what they need to do to be success here, that's my goal, and I want to serve. So since coming to repentance, because I did turn my life around, and faith to the Lord Jesus Christ in 1996, I have learned that God's work in us is not over at salvation. That is only the beginning. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. She left out a lot of blanks. But in 25 minutes, you can't tell everything. And someday, if you got some time, just stop by the office and she'll fill in some of those blanks that she couldn't talk about today. But yes, a great journey in following Jesus Christ and how God has led and worked in her life and how he can take something difficult like her father dying and bringing the right man into her life. And I, too, thank the Lord for Ed. You know, he's a great guy, one of our lead guitar players and one of our guys. I'm going to ask you to be patient this morning. We're going to have